Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. As a journalist, broadcaster, podcaster, and educator, I am, by any measure, a public persona. But there are very few people who actually know me. And those who do know one thing for sure. I love dogs. Not just my dogs, whose companionship I cherish more than most of the people I know, but all dogs. As a child and for the rest of my life, whenever I've seen a dog in need, whether it be a stray or an animal unfairly trapped in a life without close contact with humans during many hours of the day, my heartstrings have literally been tugged. All three of my best friends, Pearl, Elvis, and Ellie, not to be confused with my associate producer, Ellie Johnson, are rescue dogs, and later on in the show, I will tell you about the amazing young woman that made sure their lives and mine were intertwined. But first, dogs have been our companions for thousands of years, ever since the first canine decided to throw his or her lot in with following the hunter-gatherers that our ancestors were, warming themselves by our campfires and feeding on our scraps, that for some reason we decided to share with them, dogs have become our best animal friends. Our guest is Clive Wynn. He's an animal behavior scientist now based at Arizona State University and author of the new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. After years of investigating animal intelligence, and especially that of dogs, he became fascinated by a simple but profound question. What is it that makes dogs special? Why do we treat them as what my daughter likes to call fur babies, actual members of our families? Wynn's scientific approach to the question made it all the more remarkable that he reached an obvious but amazing conclusion. Dogs actually do feel love, or something very much like it, for their special humans. Clive Wynn joined us from Tempe, Arizona. And I like to think of you as the doggy scientist. Is that okay?
That's fine. That's fine. I'm willing to answer to that title any day, Dave.
Cool. Well, you're the author of the book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. And I read this book and found it to be totally attuned to my way of thinking about dogs. And I really enjoyed your personal story. But so what I'd like to ask you first is, tell us how you first got interested in just animal science and the science of cognition and animal behavior. When did you first get interested in that?
Well, Dave, that's a hard one for me to answer because I cannot honestly remember a time when I was not fascinated by the minds of animals. But it crystallized for me once I went to college in London. I grew up in England. I went to college in London. And when I discovered that there was such a thing as a science of animal behavior and a science of animal cognition, because I'd always thought of myself, well, not necessarily always, but growing up, I came to think of myself as a scientist. But I wanted a science that addressed something that I really cared about. And so when I was in college and discovered that there were psychologists and biologists who could study animal minds and behavior, then it all just clicked very quickly for me.
Well, one of the things I really found fascinating about many things in this book is that, you know, when you talk to a dog owner like myself and you say, you know, dogs, you know, really do love you, it's kind of like, well, duh, you know, I know that. But from a scientific point of view, it's not so easy to, you know, actually kind of go about providing evidence for that, is it?
Well, right. And I think psychologists who study animal behavior and biologists, animal behavioral biologists, we tend to shy away from things that don't feel amenable to scientific study. I mean, love, it's a very swooshy, whooshy, feely kind of thing. You know, how do we grab that and turn it into a scientific concept? And of course, in my scientific writing, we don't use the L word. You know, we're always looking for more technical sounding expressions that ultimately capture what lay people would call love. So in the study specifically of dogs and trying to understand the success of dogs, why are dogs so obvious? You know, it's easy to tell that dogs are unique. It's easy to tell that dogs are special. I mean, there are maybe a billion dogs on the surface of the planet, the most widespread large mammal after ourselves. For the longest time, scientists were reluctant to take seriously the possibility, which seems so obvious to every layperson, that dogs really love people and that might be the essence of their success in our human societies.
Well, when I read your book, it was interesting to see that, you know, your own personal journey along these lines, because the scientist in you, you know, kept wanting to be skeptical and make sure you found evidence for this. And I'd like to go back to some of the central characters in the history of this. And, you know, we've all heard of Pavlov's dogs. Could you tell us a bit about him, Ivan Pavlov? Because I found it really interesting in the book that he really seemed to care about dogs, and his experiments are so much more interesting the way you portray them than, you know, what I always read, you know, in a textbook.
Well, thank you, Dave, but I don't deserve any of the credit for that. So a few years ago now, a historian of science at Johns Hopkins University, Daniel Todes, wrote a fantastic biography of Pavlov. It's 800 pages long, but for somebody like me who's fascinated by dogs and very interested in the history of science, it really just wasn't long enough. I mean, so it turns out we knew up to before this recent biography, we really knew nothing at all about Pavlov's life. And it turns out he had a fascinating life. I mean, he lived through an amazing epoch in the history of Russia. He lived through the period leading up to the Russian Revolution, and then the Russian Revolution, and communism, and ultimately Stalinism. I mean, Pavlov spent the last years of his life trying to use what influence he could with the Soviet state to try and save the various friends, colleagues, relatives who were being assassinated by Stalin's henchpeople. I mean, it's just an amazing life. But one aspect that comes out is that Pavlov actually cared about his dogs. I mean, he was living in a different epoch. So the way that the caring expressed itself wasn't perhaps how we would hope in the modern times, but he did care about the dogs, and he did fight hard to make sure that they were well taken care of. And what I found most interesting was that, contrary to what you might expect, he gave every single one of the dogs that worked in his experiments a name, and he and his staff made notes on the personalities of the different dogs. They had a very strong recognition that each dog was an individual with its individual quirks and foibles and ways of behaving. So he, although we think of him as having studied a very simple element of behavior, and he certainly wanted to break behavior down into its smallest pieces, that's undoubtedly true, he nonetheless could see that the fullness of an individual dog's behavior, its personality, was a very rich and multifaceted thing.
And tell us about your first dog, Benji.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So when I was a kid, we had a dog, Benji, and I talk about Benji in the book. And it still gives me a glow to think back on him, even though it's been such a long time. Because, you know, he was nothing remarkable in his physique. And, you know, he was just a mongrel dog, a mixed breed dog that we picked up at the local shelter. But, you know, and I was just a kid. I had no scientific understanding of animal behavior, animal minds, animal psychology. None of that meant anything to me. I didn't even really understand at that point that sciences of that type existed, never mind what they might contain. But we knew one thing about this dog. We knew that he loved us. You know, my brother and I would come home from school, and he would charge in from out the back or from wherever he was. And certainly until he got old and was too old to be able to do this. But when he was younger and fitter, he would run in, and from wherever he was, he would literally throw himself up into the sky so that he would land on our heads and just, you know, kiss us and hit us with his wagging tail. You know, every fiber of his little body, every paw expressed his affection, his love for us. Such a powerful, powerful sensation. I mean, really amazing. And anyway, so he was so important to me at that time in my life. You know, when you're an adolescent, a teenager, and you feel that nobody really understands you and all that kind of stuff. And yet there was this being, not even a human being, just an animal being who projected that he understood me at an emotional level. It was so powerful. And I know so many other people have had this experience. I'm not claiming this was some exceptional experience. It was exceptional in its emotional power for me. But many, many people have shared that impression. And I carried that with me for years, for decades, as I became an animal psychologist as I became a scientist concerned about animal behavior and studied things like Pavlov and his Pavlovian conditioning and all the other many basic processes of animal behavior that we understand. All the way through, I carried these memories of this powerful affection that this dog had for me. And then much, much later in life, decades later, when I'm a scientist and I'm studying dog behavior and I'm struggling to understand what is the secret of dog success in human society, and I'm looking at the competing theories to try and make sense of dogs, and I'm not happy with them. So there has been and continues in some corners to be a belief that dogs evolved special forms of intelligence, that dogs have special kinds of cognition that enable them to understand people better than other animals can. Now, I'm not saying that dogs don't understand people. Of course, dogs understand people. But I don't think that they have a special form of intelligence. I think their ability to understand people stems from the closeness of the lives that dogs and people live together. And there's evidence that any animal that lives with people as closely as our dogs typically do, any animal under those circumstances can develop the same level of understanding of people. So I didn't feel that dogs had a special kind of intelligence. So it was up to me to explain, well, what is it then that's special about dogs? And thinking back on Benji, and also taking on a new dog in my life, Zephos, who gets her own chapter in my book, Dog is Love. Zephos was just like Benji in that, you know, the one thing that is so immediate and so obvious about Zephos is that she loves me and she loves my family. And she very quickly forms strong emotional attachments to other people who come around. And so I began to think, well, maybe this love thing, maybe this can be made into a scientific concept. Maybe this can be studied scientifically. And maybe this is the thing that is the secret of dog success. And I gradually became convinced of this. And I describe in the book how my students and I did various experiments, and a lot of other people have done studies as well, that all point in the same direction, that the essence of dog success in human society isn't some special intelligence. It's this amazing, amazing, ebullient capacity to form strong, loving relationships.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. If you're just joining us, our guest is Clive Wynn. He's an animal behavior scientist from Arizona State University and the author of the new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Actually Loves You. We'll be back after a short break, so stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now in our conversation about dogs, their intelligence, and their remarkable capacity to love their human companions with our guest, Arizona State animal behavior scientist Clive Wynn. He's the author of the new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Actually Loves You.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about some of the ideas about dog intelligence. Because as you say, you start to realize it's like dogs are no more, you know, super intelligent than other animals, but they can do, some of them can do amazing things, like animals that can sniff out explosives, animals that can sniff out cancers. You also describe this wonderful dog named Chaser, and I'd like you to share the story of Chaser with us and that dog's ability to understand the names of toys and lots of them. Could you tell us about Chaser a bit?
Oh, of course, of course. Unfortunately, Chaser passed on just a few months ago, and Chaser's trainer and master died a couple of years ago. So we don't have chaser anymore. That's one of the painful things about dog lives, isn't it? They're so short.
Yes.
But I like to say I knew Chaser before she was famous, because I had a mutual friend with John Pilley, Chaser's owner and trainer. And so I was put in touch with Chaser before she was widely known, but she became, you know, as famous as a dog can be. The BBC called her the world's smartest dog. And it really was amazing. We went and we visited John Pilley and Chaser in South Carolina where they lived. And I remember John had this collection of the kinds of toys that you get for dogs or for small children, squishy toys, balls, frisbees, all those kinds of things. And he had them in boxes out on his back deck. And he told me to go to the back deck and collect at random 10 of the toys from these many boxes containing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. On every toy, he had written in a Sharpie marker, he'd written a name for every single one of them. And he said to me, write down the names of the 10 you select on this notepad, hide the toys behind the sofa where I and Chaser cannot see what toys you've selected and what you're doing. Hide the toys behind the sofa, come and get me, and I'll sit down on the sofa facing away from what you've put there and hand me the notepad. And so I did all of this. And then he just read from the notepad the names of the toys. And he said, okay, Chaser, go get the whatever the first one was. And Chaser runs around behind the sofa. And just like a human being would, she looks at them. She seems a little bit short-sighted. She gets quite close to them to look at them. But she looks at them. And with barely a moment's hesitation, she picks one of the 10, brings it round to John. John gets it off her. He doesn't remember the names he's given. You think an ordinary man would remember 1,200 arbitrary names that he's given a whole bunch of toys? No, he doesn't remember. He has to first of all get Chaser to give him the toy so he can read where he's written a note, a name on the, usually on the wash tag or on the body of the toy itself. And then only then can he confirm that she's got the right thing. And she did it time and time and time again. I must have seen her go through 40 or 50 toys, always getting the right one, even though John can't remember himself what names he gave them. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing.
So Clive, what kind of names did he give them? Like, can you think of an example? What kind of names were they?
Oh, there was one he called Lips. If it was a toy that was an animal, he might just call it the name of the animal. Like if it looked like a giraffe, it was supposed to be a giraffe, he'd call it giraffe. But there was one with the letters of the alphabet. He called it ABC. I remember that one. There was one that was sort of these large sort of mouth, and he called that Lips. So he's always just, you know, coming up with. It's not like, after all, Chaser, smart as she is, she doesn't know the English language, so it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Just had to. In fact, why did he stop at 1,200? Why didn't he keep going, see how many could, what might the limit have been? He had to stop at 1,200 because he couldn't even, not only could he not remember the names he'd given them, although he had notes about that, but he would find that he was buying duplicates. So he couldn't even remember that he'd previously purchased this or that toy. So he just had to give up because he was running into his own memory capacity problems. And he wasn't even trying to memorize the names. He had the names written down. And yet she just kept going. And she didn't slow down in her learning. I thought she might have shown signs that, as it were, her brain was filling up because she might have slowed down in her learning. But actually her learning continued at a very, very steady rate. They were doing this for 3 years, 3 hours a day, most days of the week for 3 years, they kept going at him.
And she was a border collie, right?
She was a border collie. Now, border collies have tended to score very high on any kind of tests of intelligence. But it needs to be kept in mind that one major issue, if you want to train a dog to do anything, on a task that's going to take many hours a day for many days a week and years, one issue is how are you going to motivate that animal to keep working? And certainly if you were going to work with my dog, you would have to use food treats. Well, you can't keep giving a dog food treats 3 hours a day. I mean, that dog's going to get very large. It's not healthy to give out that many food treats. So one of the things with border collies is that they are often very, very highly motivated to chase things. They have a very intense drive to chase around after things. And that's why Chaser was called Chaser, because she had an exceptionally high chase drive. And so the only reward that she ever received for collecting the correct object is that John would throw that object and give her the opportunity to chase after it. That was her reward. And unlike a food treat reward that an animal will fill up on, there's no filling up on the opportunity to chase something. She was always highly motivated to keep chasing things.
And let's talk a little bit about our dog's closest ancestors in the canids, which are wolves. And you describe going to a place where wolves have been basically reared and befriended by humans. What were some of the principal findings that you discovered between the differences and similarities between wolves and dogs?
Well, absolutely, Dave. So I was very, very fortunate that early on in my history of studying dogs, I was contacted by the people out at Wolf Park in Indiana. And at Wolf Park, they have been hand-rearing wolves since 1974. So I don't think there's anywhere, certainly in the United States, probably in the world, where people have such a long history of experience in hand-rearing wolves. And that's important because although all of our dogs are descended from wolves, and although our geneticist friends tell us that wolves and dogs are still extremely closely related, the genetic difference is very, very small, nonetheless, there are crucial changes in a few genes that have had big behavioral impacts. And one of those big behavioral impacts is that whereas it's so easy to tame dogs, that a lot of people, a vast number of people, are unaware that every individual dog pup does need to be tamed, does need to be given the opportunity to learn how to make friends with people. Otherwise, it will end up as just like a wild animal. It's so easy to tame dogs, but it's very, very much more difficult to tame wolves or indeed any other kind of wild animal. So the people out at Wolf Park have been doing this for over 40 years now, and they are really, really good at hand-rearing wolves so that those wolves are willing to accept human beings as social companions. And that's crucial in a number of respects because you just cannot do the kinds of tests on the comparing the behavior and intelligence of dogs and wolves. You cannot do those unless you have wolves who are willing to interact with people. You can't go out into the forest and, to give one example, a very simple test, it's just pointing and seeing whether the animal goes where you point. Well, you can do that with your dog at home. You'll find your dog goes where you point. But if you tried to go out in the forest and find a wolf to do that with, the wolves are not going to let you get anything like close enough to do that experiment. So it's absolutely crucial that you have very carefully and successfully hand-reared wolves for any of the kinds of tests that are important when you're trying to figure out what makes dogs unique. To be able to do any of those kinds of tests, you have to have very nicely hand-reared wolves as your research subjects.
Well, you mentioned the pointing experiment, and I'd like you to describe that to us a little more in detail.
Sure. Well, that's become a crux thing. So next time you have a moment with your dog, Dave, put two cups on the ground, each a couple or 3 feet away from you, depending quite how big your dog is, and ask somebody else to hold your dog back, let's say about 6 feet away from you, directly opposite you. And point at one of these containers on the ground. And what you'll find is most people find most of the time that your dog goes to the container that you point at. And that seems very simple and natural to us. But 15 plus years ago, it created a lot of excitement among people who were trying to understand what makes dogs special, because it appeared at first that dogs were unique in the animal kingdom in their ability to do that. It appeared to be a uniquely dog ability. But then around 10 years ago now, maybe a bit more, when I first went out to Wolf Park, I had the opportunity to try this on these wolves that had been hand-reared by people who really knew what they were doing when they were hand-rearing the wolves. And what we found was that actually the wolves were just as good at that as your ordinary dog at home. So that it wasn't some special unique ability that had evolved in dogs in the journey that they took from their wolf ancestors. No, it's present in their wolf ancestors. And actually since then, we and others have demonstrated that the ability to follow human pointing gestures is present in a great many animals. It doesn't depend on what species that animal comes from. It depends on what that individual animal's experiences around people have been like. If an animal, even from a wild species, like a wolf, or we worked with bats, others have worked with dolphins, even if the animal is from a wild species, if it has spent a lot of time around people, has learned as a young thing to accept humans as social companions, and continues to interact with people on a regular daily basis, then it will follow a pointing gesture. And on the other hand, if the animal is left to live in the wild with the others of its kind and doesn't have social relationships with people and doesn't depend on people for its food and for other things through its life, well, then it won't follow a human pointing gesture. So it's not a question, the ability to follow pointing gestures is not a question of your evolution. It's not a nature issue. It's a nurture issue. It's what was your individual life like? Who did you grow up among? Who do you live with now? That's what's crucial in determining an animal's success in following human gestures.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Clive Wynn, and who I like to call him a doggy scientist. He is a canine science. He's the founder of the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University and the author of the new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Loves You. Let's get back to your doggy, Zephys, and tell us about how she found you or your family found her.
Well, so we hadn't had a dog for a while. My family hadn't had a dog for a while. We moved internationally and we had a new baby, various things. So I'd had a dogless life. The first so many years that I was studying dog behavior and dog psychology, there was no dog in my own home. And so I'd had dogs in the past, several dogs over many years. So I had a sense what it's like to live with a dog, but there's nothing compares to the visceral experience of having your own dog in your own life. And so I would spend my days at work studying other people's dogs, reading scientific papers about dogs, and then I would come home to this being who was just so present. And in this very specific way that she was just so loving. There's nothing more characteristic about her. Dave, if you came through my front door now, after an initial bark at the surprise that there's somebody at the door, you would immediately get this strong sense that she was projecting affection towards you. So really, it's a really powerful, powerful sensation. And so having her in my life and having her telling me this in her way began to then influence my scientific thinking. And I began, it was difficult at first because this wasn't the way I was trained to do science. You don't do science by having emotional experiences at home and then taking them into the lab with you. That seemed completely backwards, but she forced me to do it. And she was right. She was completely right. That is the essence, not just of my relationship with Zephos, but I'm now convinced the essence of everybody's relationship with their dog. It's all about dogs. Desire, capacity, drive to form strong emotional bonds. That's the essence of these funny little animals.
And one of your interesting findings over the years is that dogs are pretty resilient. For example, Zephos, she wasn't originally your dog. She was somebody else's. You found her in a shelter, right?
Well, that's right. That's right. She was already a year old and she was born in one shelter. And we were able to find the records, and her mother was abandoned, pregnant, so gave birth at a shelter. The pups were very sickly, and then she was adopted into a family, and I'll never understand why, but that original family gave her up again at 1 year of age, 12 months of age. And then we found her in this shelter, and she was such a poor, frightened little thing, you know? She was really unhappy, and yet she somehow... I don't know how to make a scientific study of this, but I wonder whether any of your listeners have had this feeling when they've adopted a dog, that it wasn't they who made the choice, that the dog somehow selected them and convinced them. I mean, I really feel this. I really believe this, both when I think about Zephos and when I think back to when I was a kid and we got Benji. I really feel that sometimes the dog just says, hey, I'm your dog, you know? that somehow, I don't know how to make that into a scientific study, but I really feel that sometimes dogs can just tell us that we are for them and they are for us.
Absolutely. And let me share a story with you from my own experience. And I've heard this from many other people, because my niece is the queen of dog rescue. She works for a veterinarian, and in all of her spare time, she rescues dogs and finds them homes. And about 4 years ago on Christmas Eve, I went to visit her, and under her tree was this kind of raggedy looking German Shepherd, and she was in a kennel. And there was a little blanket over her, and Jenny said, oh, you know, I said, well, have you got any new dogs? You know, what's going on? Because she's always got dogs that she's fostering until she adopts them out. And she uncovered this kennel, and this dog looked at me, and it was just instant. It was like, you know, the saying, love at first sight. It was just this feeling that this dog was meant for me. And I knew right then that, you know, and I started to lobby Cheryl, my partner, you know, it's like, yeah, she's got this dog and it's German Shepherd and I really, 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 really like it. And I'll feed it and take care of it and everything, Mom. And, you know, kind of started doing the whole lobbying campaign. And then, you know, finally, like a couple of weeks later, she's like, you know, you're going to, you know, get this dog. Stop doing this and just adopt her. And I have. And so Ellie's been a big part of my life ever since. She was very pregnant. It's interesting, my niece, when she adopts these dogs, especially when they're pregnant, and she specializes in that, she always kind of has a theme for the puppies. And I named Ellie after Ellie Mae Clampett on the Beverly Hillbillies, because Ellie Mae loved animals, and I just thought it was appropriate. And so we named all of the puppies after characters on the Beverly Hillbillies TV show. You know, there was Jethro and Granny and Milburn for Milburn Drysdale. And all of those puppies have been adopted. They were beautiful. And I'll probably put a picture of them on our post when we post the show. But it was really an interesting experience, because it was exactly like you said. It was like that dog, she looked at me and said, I'm yours. You know it. I know it. And it was just like powerful experience.
Yeah. No, well, that's their special skill. I mean, they feel it and they express it so unreservedly, you know. I mean, I'm British by birth, and we Brits are often accused of being emotionally somewhat not the most expressive of people.
Reserved.
Reserved. And I just so love dogs for being the absolute opposite of that, but holding nothing back, you know, that they're just totally emotionally present and projecting everything that they feel. It's one of their most wonderful qualities.
Yeah. And yet I like to think that, you know, anybody else that had looked at her, she would have been, nope, I'm waiting for Dave.
Well, I don't know. You know, it would be so interesting, Dave, to be able to figure out how to make this into a scientific study, because it would be interesting to know, does everybody feel the same way about every dog, or is it more of a matchmaking kind of a thing? We just don't know. What we do know, and I think this is worth drawing people's attention to. So dogs are resilient. I mean, that's never an excuse for maltreating them. Absolutely not. But it is interestingly clearly true that dogs can go on to form strong emotional bonds and have wonderful, loving relationships with people, having perhaps had worse experiences with other people in the past. And people have sometimes said to me that maybe talking about love in dogs is anthropomorphic. You know, when I'm teaching we use this term anthropomorphism. It means giving animals human qualities. And it's a mistake. It's a mistake to think that other species have human qualities. But on the other hand, it's clear to me that there is enough similarity between the way that humans form loving relationships and the way that dogs form loving relationships, that even though humans and dogs, we're not relatives, you know, we human beings, we're primates, and dogs are carnivores, you know, we're not closely related on the evolutionary family tree. And yet, even though we're not closely related, clearly the way we form emotional connections have enough points of similarity that we can form strong bonds across this great species difference. And that's a quite wonderful thing. You know, we take it for granted because we're all accustomed to it. But if you stop and think about it, it's quite magical. It's really special.
Let's take a short break. You are listening to Blue Dot, and we're talking to Clive Wynn. He's an animal behavior scientist who specializes in dogs and the author of the new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Actually Loves You. Stay with us and give your doggie an added treat if she or he is listening to public radio with you. And we're back. If you have a dog, give him a neck rub as we continue our conversation with Clive Wynn. He's the animal behavior scientist from Arizona State who wrote the new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Actually Loves You. Well, let's get back to some of the experiments and the actual data that backs up your idea that dogs really have this incredible emotional bond. One of the things that I notice about dogs, and I'm not the only one, is that dogs are the only animals that I know of that will actually make eye contact with you and hold it and watch your face. I don't notice that in other animals as much.
So if you go out to a wolf park in Indiana and you hang out with the wolves, they can and do make eye contact. They do. Now, we need to allow for the fact that humans are exceptionally visual animals. Other animals just don't usually have such good vision as we do. Mm-hmm. But there can be eye contact with other species. Maybe you're right. Maybe dogs more than others. That's an interesting question I haven't looked at. But I have noticed the wolves making eye contact with me, partly because it always makes me a little bit anxious, because I remember being told that it could be considered an aggressive thing to make eye contact with a wolf, although I'm not entirely sure that that's true. But the science that dogs care for us is many faceted and at many, many levels. I mean, there are very simple things that people can do themselves at home with their dogs that quickly show how much our dogs care about us. One that I wish I'd thought of it myself, it was actually thought up by some researchers in London. You just sit down on the sofa and pretend to cry. Just pretend to cry. And you find that dogs come over and they're very concerned, and they seek out a person and try and comfort them. I mean, it's, if you're only pretending to cry, it's really funny because, you know, the dog is so concerned and upset. Amazing that they're taken in, but they really do show a lot of concern. We've started an experiment where we have people crawl into a box that is, and then we close the door on them. And then we have them cry out in distress, help, help, help me, help me. And a lot of dogs will rescue their owner from the box if the owner appears to be trapped inside and the box is easy enough to open. It has to be said that dogs don't easily grasp how to open things, but if we make the box really easy to open, then we find a lot of dogs will help their owner get out. And that's just the very simple behavioral studies that pretty much anybody can do. There are also studies that we and others have done that look at dogs' biology at many different levels of analysis. And we find at all sorts of different levels, we find evidence for how dogs care for people.
And there's some like studies of hormones and also MRIs where you can actually see brain activity. Can you tell us a bit about some of that?
Of course. So this is work from a scientist at Emory University in Atlanta, Gregory Burns. And he trained dogs, quite a few dogs now, to lie very still in MRI scanners, which is very difficult to do. I don't know if any of your listeners have been in an MRI scanner, but it's quite scary. It's noisy. very confining, but with very gentle training over months, several months of time, they were able to train the dogs to lie perfectly still in the scanner. You can only get clear images of the brain activity if the individual holds their head perfectly still. So it really is very careful training. And then you show the dog signals that tell the dog either that their owner is close by, a person who they love, or that the chance to have a small piece of hot dog is close by. And you can then look at how the brain centers for reward light up when you show them those different signals. And for most dogs, you get more intense activation of the brain center for reward when you show them a signal that means that their owner is close by than when you show them a signal that means that a piece of hot dog is close by. So you've got really powerful direct brain evidence of the dog's interest in their owner being greater even than their interest in a hot dog, which certainly surprised me when I first heard about it, although we've subsequently done our own studies that show much the same thing in a very different way. And then out in Japan, there are scientists who can measure the levels of oxytocin, which is, people call oxytocin the love hormone because its levels spike when people look into the eyes of individuals that they love. So when mothers look into the eyes of their infants, or when newly enamored people look into each other's eyes, you get spikes in the levels of this hormone oxytocin. And these Japanese researchers were able to do this. They brought people with their dogs into the lab, and they were able to measure the level of oxytocin in the people and in their dogs while they looked into each other's eyes. And they found these same spikes in the levels of the hormone when the people and the dogs were looking into each other's eyes lovingly. So you see at the level of hormones, at the level of brain activity. You know, there's even a study, Dave, from Australia where they put heart rate monitors onto people and onto their dogs. And when the people and the dogs sat down and snuggled together on a sofa, they found first that the heart rates of both partners go down, which is how they're relaxing, how being together relaxes them. But also, their hearts start beating in synchrony, you know, like the cliche, two hearts beating as one, you know. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what they find in scientific measurements of heartbeats of dogs and people snuggling together, that their hearts beat as one. Just amazing. It comes through again and again at one level of analysis after another.
Wow. That's amazing. It's interesting, you know, hearing about all this and thinking back to my childhood, and I think we're about the same age. So, you know, a central figure growing up was Lassie. Lassie, you know, on TV and in movies. And of course the famous, you know, Timmy's fallen in the well, and Lassie's going to run off and save him. What about the Timmy experiment?
Well, so it's funny. It's funny because I do understand from talking to people over here that if I had grown up in the United States, I would have grown up with Lassie. But the Lassie TV show was, to my knowledge, not shown in Britain, interestingly. So I didn't quite, I knew the movie and the original book, but people would tell me things from the TV show and I couldn't make any sense what they were talking about. But I have subsequently educated myself so that I know what's being talked about with the TV show. And I certainly know about the Timmy's fallen down the well story. And indeed, researchers in Canada actually made a direct experiment of that. So they actually had people walk their dogs in parks, and at a predetermined spot in the park, the person pretended to have a heart attack and let go of the dog's leash. And another person was sitting nearby, and they observed, they secretly video recorded, well, not secretly, but the dog didn't know they were video recording. They video recorded what the dog did when the person pretended to have the heart attack. Did the dog go to this other person and try and somehow solicit some help from them? And what they found, and I remember this was one of the funniest things I ever heard presented at a scientific conference, these video recordings, one dog after another, lies down next to their prostrate owner. And not a single dog tried to get help in any way whatsoever. And at the time, I thought this was very disappointing. It was very funny as a conference presentation. And it seemed very disappointing because it seemed to indicate that the dogs didn't care about their owners. But then I thought, well, you know, how's the dog supposed to know what to do? I mean, of course, there's the question, does the dog think the person actually is in harm or think the person is just resting. You know, maybe the dog thinks the person is just resting. But even if the dog does think the person's in some kind of difficulty, how's a dog supposed to know what to do about it? I mean, the dog cannot speak. So how is it supposed to convey to this other human being that it needs some help in some way? And then not very long ago, I was reading a book about dogs, animals in general, pets in general, in England during the Second World War. And there are many interesting aspects to that. But the thing that struck me was that during the war, there were many accounts of dogs, houses that have been bombed, owners trapped under the rubble. Dog gets out from under the rubble and then tries to pull or dig their owner out. And I thought, well, that's very interesting. Why is that so different from the situation that the Canadian researchers found when the person pretended to have a heart attack? And I thought, well, perhaps the difference lies in the fact that the dog understands what you need to do. If somebody is trapped, is buried, the dog needs to dig and to pull. And digging and pulling, those may be actions that dogs know how to do. Whereas going over to a human being and explaining, help, help, my master is in some kind of difficulty, that may be too intellectually challenging for the dogs. So I thought maybe the failure of the Canadian experiment didn't lie in the dog's lack of sympathy and empathy with their humans. It lay in their lack of intellectual capacity to understand what needed to be done. And that's then what led to the experiment I mentioned earlier, where we have people crawl into a box and cry out in distress, where the box is intentionally designed that it's very, very easy to open the door to it. It doesn't impose the same intellectual demands as the Canadian scientists imposed on the dogs when they were expecting them to go over to somebody and somehow ask for help.
It also seems to me that from the dog's point of view, laying there as a protector and companion when the person is in that state of, you know, being out of it, that might also seem like a natural way to them to do the right thing.
Well, right, Dave, that does. That does seem like it could be a halfway reasonable thing to do. It has to be said that some of the dogs, and these were the absolute funniest videos, some of the dogs, the owner goes, ugh, lies down on the ground in this park. Some of the dogs did one or two laps around their resting owner and then seemed to realize that nobody was holding on to the other end of the leash. And then whoosh, they just disappeared into the woods on the edge of the parkland. I don't think they were running to get help. I don't know how they ever got those ones back. It was really very funny to watch.
Well, that sounds like dogs too. You also talk a bit about, there was a big fad in dog training a few years back about like the alpha leader, you know, the pack leader, and the dogs have to be in packs and you have to be the leader of the pack. And some of those training methods, you know, seemed to me, you know, when I was kind of trying to investigate them myself, a little too, domineering and not. The way I like to treat my dogs now is just a more of a cooperative thing where, you know, they know I'm in charge and, you know, and I'll let them know when they've crossed a boundary, but trying to do it in a more loving way. What's your take on that?
Well, that's right, Dave. I mean, it's a tragedy in many ways that this misunderstanding of what dogs need and how dogs live with people and indeed with other dogs has led to a resurgence of a really quite brutal approach to living with dogs. I don't call dogs pack animals. There's a lot of problems understanding what pack even means in wolves, where really a wolf pack, it's just a family. You know, the alpha are just mom and dad, and the others are the young from last year and the young from this year. It's not like a military organization. It's just a family. And that's with wolves. Dogs don't even have that. Dogs have a very fluid social structure. But when our dogs live with us, they clearly recognize us as the leaders of this group. And you don't have to do anything. You certainly don't have to impose any force into your dog's life to enable your dog to understand that you are the leader. Your dog knows that you are the one who knows how to operate the can opener, who provides the food, who can open the fridge. Your dog knows that you are the one who, I was saying to some people the other night, if you live with a dog and you are the one that puts the collar and the leash on the dog when you go for a walk, then you are in charge. That's all it takes. Now, if you live in a situation where your dog is putting a leash and a collar on you, then you've got a problem. But I've never met anybody who has that circumstance. I don't know anybody whose dog feeds them or whose dog takes them for a walk. It just doesn't occur. And it's those basic things, providing access to those things that your dog needs in life, that make you your dog's leader. Now, the term dominance is used in behavioral biology with a very specific technical meaning. And it's probably not helpful to use that term among people who haven't studied behavioral biology, because the ordinary English word dominance has all sorts of coercive implications, which we just don't want it to mean when we're using it as a technical term in behavioral biology. The term dominance in behavioral biology is better understood in ordinary English as leadership. Your dog looks to you for leadership, and it's up to you to provide compassionate, gentle leadership. That's all your dog is asking for. And to bring coercion and violence and pain into your dog's life is completely counterproductive. It's completely mistaken, quite tragically misguided, in my view.
I would add to that that another part of that equation of leadership is also time, is that, you know, I spend a lot of time with my dogs because they are important to me and I'm important to them. So I give them my time and they're more than willing to give me theirs. And I think that's a big part of it. Clive, it was just amazing talking to you about your work with dogs. And I love the book, Dog is Love. And I wish you the very best with it. And thanks for sharing all your knowledge about dog behavior with us on Blue Dot.
Of course, it was my pleasure entirely. Thank you for having me on, Dave.
Thanks again to our guest from Arizona State University, Dr. Clive Wynn. You can get his new book, Dog is Love, Why and How Your Dog Actually Loves You, from most major booksellers. My three canine companions, Pearl and Elvis, the little terriers, and Ellie the German Shepherd, are all dogs that I adopted through Deserving Pet Rescue in Northern California. My niece, Jennifer, is one of the most amazing and heroic people I know. She has rescued hundreds of dogs, specializing in pregnant females and seriously ill or injured animals in need of special care and very special human homes. I marvel at her dedication to dogs and even more at her ability to find homes for dogs that almost certainly would have a slim shot at a life in a loving home. So with the love of hundreds of my doggy friends all over and mine, I dedicate this show to her. You can find a link to donate to Deserving Pet Rescue in our show description, or I encourage you to donate your time or money to your local pet rescue organization. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is my other wonderful friend named Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.